Welcome to the space show, Ed.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
What's your job at NASA?
So I'm one of the NASA flight directors. There are about 25 of us in the office, and we're all working various things, and my primary focus is the International Space Station.
Most people probably have seen the movie Apollo 13, and the flight director shown there, very famous person.
Right, so Gene Kranz is the prominent flight director in that movie that everybody probably identifies with the white vest. Obviously not the only flight director working the mission. There were at least four, but that's the role that I maintain also, and it's a great heritage to be able to link back to those days of human spaceflight.
But you don't wear the white vest.
No, that was an iconic thing. We'll just let Gene own that one. And actually, that vest that he wore in Apollo 13 is actually in the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C.
So what does flight director involve?
Well, it's a wide range of activities that we do, but it all boils down to being the responsible authority for the successful execution of a mission. And what that means is that we are in charge of the spaceflight mission, be it space station, space shuttle, Orion, upcoming missions, anything like that. So we have a team that we orchestrate to help accomplish the goals that the various programs have identified for us to do beyond the atmosphere.
And you work on the space station. Did you work the shuttle before that?
So space station has always been my career path. I've only been certified to do various things with the space station, but obviously space shuttle came and visited us quite a bit and was the vehicle used to assemble the space station. So I did work on various space shuttle missions, both as a flight controller and also as a flight director, but it was always on the space station side.
So what's a typical day for a flight director?
I don't know if there is a typical day, but you know, it depends. You can break it down into, say, maybe three different facets. The first one is what's most visible to everybody in mission control when you're on console, and that's a nine-hour shift. We work three shifts a day with an hour overlap at the beginning and the end. And when you see us in that role, that's when we have the overall authority and responsibility for completing the mission as it's being executed that day. So we're helping the crew get their activities done. And we work about 30% of a year in the control room. So what's the other 70%? The other thing we do is we help train the flight controllers. And so we're constantly running simulations, both of a generic nature, to help just with getting people certified and trained. And then also a mission-specific simulations to get ready for, say, an upcoming spacewalk or cargo mission or something like that. And then finally, the other thing that we're doing is we're always planning and working with our teams for the next thing that we've been assigned to. And that thing could be a spacewalk, a cargo mission, a Soyuz launch and docking, and then some of the longer range projects like the upcoming commercial crew program, and then going beyond Earth, so working with Orion and the exploration program.
Is Orion well along now?
So it is. We've completed the exploration flight test one mission, as you know, in December of 2014, which was the first flight of Orion. And we're working hard on getting ready for the next flight of Orion, the EM-1 mission, exploration mission number one. And that's going to take us out into cislunar space again and out further than Apollo went, which is going to be truly remarkable. But it's also a test flight, so there's no crew on that mission. It will be controlled from Houston, and we're going to put Orion through all of its paces to make sure it's truly ready to send people beyond Earth.
Do you expect to be working on that mission?
So right now, my trajectory keeps me in the space station realm. I'll be working space station and then also the commercial crew program. Have not yet been tapped to work Orion, but as we get closer and start stacking these missions up, the EM-2 following in just a couple years after, we're going to need to pull some more flight directors over to that. I'd certainly be open to it. It's going to be exciting, but honestly, everything we're doing with Space Station in low Earth orbit is also really a spectacular set of adventures, too, getting all the research and science done there.
So at the moment, you're looking over the fence, keeping an eye on what's going on.
You always have to keep an eye on what's going on, and that's... you know, our purview as flight directors is very broad, and we're always making sure that we are aware of, you know, what the various programs are doing, and that's not only within NASA, but then what are our Russian colleagues doing? What are the, you know, the Chinese program? What are they doing? In the U.S., you've got Virgin Galactic and other companies that are not necessarily going to the space station, but getting ready to send people. So it's good to keep an eye on human spaceflight in general, and be ready to you know, support in any way that we're called upon.
So working on the space station, you said there's not a typical day, but you know, on a routine basis, what exactly are you doing with the space station?
So in a just kind of a broad brush sense, the primary objective of the space station is to complete fundamental research and science that can only be accomplished in low Earth orbit. And that can range from combustion science to materials research. We have experiments outside of the space station in vacuum and telescopes and all sorts of things outside. And then, of course, the crew is working hands-on inside the space station to do all sorts of various research, including a lot of human research on themselves and their crewmates. So my job as the flight director is to enable that science to happen. And so I'm, if you think of it as a laboratory like on the Earth, you know, there's one facet, which is the building and the facilities and the resources that the scientists need in order to do the science. And so my job is to make sure that the laboratory is always up and running, always able to provide the resources that the scientists need. And then for NASA research, we have an entire different control center in Huntsville, Alabama, that orchestrates and works with the crew to accomplish that science. And so what we want to do is make sure that the crew has the most time available as possible to do that science, and then we hand them over to Huntsville to actually implement that research, and then we help make sure that that data and information comes back to the ground.
Do you need to be familiar with the actual experiments?
At a high level, we are, and most of that has to do with getting an understanding of what facilities the crew will be using, the resources they need, the amount of time that's required, any safety-related items that are involved. We look to make sure that one astronaut doesn't have to be in the same facility as another one, trying to do, you know, two things in one spot, things like that. Try to deconflict all the constraints, but at the microscopic level, we just don't have, usually we don't have enough, the details available, but we don't usually have that expertise. It'll be in Huntsville. But some of the bigger things, that like the rodent research set of missions that the agency is doing on the space station right now, is something that we're all pretty well versed on.
Do things even go wrong?
Every day, well, you know, define going wrong. Everybody thinks about Apollo 13 or something, you know, life or death when they ask that question. And so the answer to that is no. But every day is different and unique. And so you really never know what you're going to walk into, because every day we're doing something in space that's never been done before. It might be really small, but I mean, that's the whole point of the space station, is to do science that you really can't do anywhere else. And generally, it hasn't been done before, so we always run into small complications that we have to work with the crew to help resolve them, or adjust the timeline, or things like that. And then sometimes the spacecraft itself doesn't always behave, and so you have equipment breakdowns sometime that you have to work out. It's been in orbit for 1998 was the first Element launch, and we've had humans on board for over 15 years now, so you know, as the vehicle ages, we've got to take that into account and keep it running. But she's in great shape too, so nothing too horrible, to be honest.
Luca Parmitano, sorry, pronunciation there. The Italian astronaut got into trouble when he was doing a spacewalk. What happened there?
Right. So what happened was, probably need to talk a little bit about the spacesuit design, and the spacesuit is a spacecraft in itself. It's a small spacecraft, and the astronaut inside the spacesuit generates heat. The electronics and everything inside the spacesuit generates heat, and so you have to have a way to get that heat out of the spacesuit and reject that to into space. And so the way that's done is through a water loop, and so undergarments the astronauts wear have little tubes, and the water runs through the tubes, and the water also circulates around the electronics, and then goes to, in an ideal sense, when it's all working properly, goes to a, it's a sublimator, and so the heat flashes to the ice pack and gets radiated out to space. Well, in an ideal world, that water circulates in a closed system, and the astronauts never have any water in their suit. And unfortunately, with Luca, is that some clogs kind of built up within the some components of that water circulation loop, and it allowed the water to change the way it was flowing to where it actually started flowing in. It went into the vent loop, is what they call it, but where the oxygen comes into the suit. And started flowing into the suit with the oxygen, and so we started to get a bubble of water in the suit, and it went from a non-issue to quickly becoming something we needed to take care of right away. And there was so the response to that was the crew, both the ground crew and Luca and Chris Cassidy, they all followed their training. And they terminated the EVA, which is a specific word. It means to do specific things. And got Luca inside, got the helmet off, and then they worked the investigation of that afterwards. But that was probably one of our scarier moments, right? Because that certainly, if we hadn't implemented the training that we have and implemented the precautions that we have, then he certainly, the media talks about how he almost drowned, and that would be true if we hadn't taken any action, right? But our job is, number one job on a spacewalk is to get the crew back inside safely, so we put that into work right away.
Space walking, of course, being one of the most dangerous things that astronauts do.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So powered flight is obviously the most dangerous when you're either accumulating all the energy it takes to stay in orbit, or you're dropping all that energy to come back home. Obviously, anytime you play with that amount of energy, it's a very dangerous endeavor. But when you take a human and put them in a very small, individualized spacecraft and stick them out in the vacuum of space, that's definitely the next most dangerous thing we do. Anytime I do a spacewalk, right before we open the hatch, I remind my team the number one thing we have as our priority is to get the crew back inside. And it's okay if we don't send them outside, because if something's not quite right, then inside is the better place to be to work through that than outside.
So a decision to terminate a spacewalk or not go outside or whatever, is that the sort of decision you would make alone, or do you make it in consultation with lots of other people?
Well, a little bit of both. So the ultimate responsibility in decision-making is the flight directors alone. They will take inputs from within the flight control team. And so we have flight rules and documentation that, for some actions, prescribes exactly what we're supposed to do. And in other cases, we take the input of that flight control team and then make the decision. The decision-making would be the flight director. The one thing, when we're executing an operation, we're not going to every other organization to solicit their permission to take an action, for example. It's not to say that we are not looking for inputs. We certainly are. But the actual final decision-making is going to be at the flight director's level.
What took you from being a child in America to flight director? What sort of career path did you have?
For me, it all got started with a Space Shuttle Challenger. So as you know, in 1986, we had a teacher on our way into space for the first time, and unfortunately Challenger was lost shortly after liftoff. And a tragic event, for sure, but not just myself, but really a whole generation of space-excited people that were school-age children in those days. It was their first awareness of space shuttle and space flight, and that's true for me. So that sparked my awareness, and I thought that was interesting. I wanted to find out more about it, but as I got a little bit older, I was able to attend space camp in Alabama, in Huntsville, twice, and that actually helped me take a vague notion of, wow, that's cool, to really understanding that I could participate in it, and what that participation might look like, and what career path I might need, or study path I might need to do to in order to get into that line of work. And so once I was set in that direction, I attended University of Michigan to study aerospace engineering. And one of the reasons I chose that university, besides the fact that it's, of course, a great school, is that they have a close relationship with the Johnson Space Center. And if I wanted to work in human spaceflight, Johnson Space Center is the place to go. And the way to get in there is through a cooperative education program. And so in Michigan had that relationship with Johnson Space Center. So I worked. I ended up working for NASA at Johnson Space Center for a year while I was attending school. And that got me set into mission operations. And I hired into mission operations full time after graduation. And I got certified as an operations support officer, which is one of the consoles in mission control for space station, certified in a couple of different areas as well, and then was a lead of a group of individuals that are responsible for flight controller and astronaut training. Got some more experience in leadership and teamwork and integration skills. Applied to be a flight director a couple of times and was selected in 2009 along with two other classmates. And yeah, so now I was certified in January of 2010 and have been doing it ever since.
So flight director is not something you drift into. You've got to aspire to do it.
Yeah, at some point you have to decide to do it. And then you need to really spend time researching what it means. Because, you know, with every job that looks and sounds really spectacular, from, you know, flight director to astronaut to Grand Prix driver, because we're here on Grand Prix Day, you know, all of those jobs that look fantastic, they all have other aspects to them that you need to really understand and decide that, yes, it's something I really want to pursue. So I did that work and decided I still wanted to do it. And, yeah, worked hard to go achieve it, for sure. It's not something you just throw your hat in and hope.
Well, what opportunities do you see in the future as a career in NASA or outside of it?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one I should have an answer to, but I'm just having a spectacularly fun time being a flight director right now. But when I look at my colleagues that have gone beyond the flight director office, the directions that folks tend to go is pretty wide, and there's a lot of opportunities. For example, the commercial crew industry is just getting started and rolling, and so there's opportunities there if you wanted to leave government. You could go to work in the space station program or the Orion program or other centers around NASA, even at NASA headquarters. So there's definitely lots of options. I haven't looked into them a whole lot just because I'm having so much fun where I am right now.
Looking at the space station, how long will it operate for? And is it helping in that thrust to get humans towards Mars?
There are really two answers to the question of how long it'll operate. There's a international will that has to be there. So it's not just the United States Space Station. It's an international collaboration that really will not work without all of the international partners. The space station's one integrated vehicle, and it really needs commitment from all of the international partners. So as long as all of the partnership is committed to keeping the space station going, then you know, people are talking about 2024, 2028, perhaps even longer. And of course, governments like to use dates so they know how to set up funding and things like that. From an engineering perspective, there's going to be a point where the structure and the actual space station itself is no longer going to be engineering-wise safe to commit sending people to. And honestly, don't know exactly when that'll be. What we're doing right now is certifying it to definitively be safe up to a certain date. So right now, we're absolutely certain 2024 is a good date. We're working to certify it to be good to 2028. And as soon as that's done, I'm sure we'll keep working to certify it to be you know, up there for longer. I'd like to see it fly until like we get to the point where it's just not safe to do it, or because something even bigger and better is in orbit, and we're ready to go transition to that.
So that's what happened to the Mir space station.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So Mir was had gotten old, and it was a great spacecraft, but there's a certain tipping point where the maintenance of it gets to be a bit much, and then the way I understand it, too, is you know, the financial commitments to flying two space stations for the Russian government was a bit much, and so everybody wanted to move forward with the International Space Station, and so that meant having to deorbit the Mir space station.
Is there active planning going on as to how to deorbit it, or is it something you worry about sometime in the future?
No, there is a good deal of planning to be able to do that. Any satellite that gets put into orbit needs to have a disposal plan, and the space station, as much as I love having people up there in the broadest sense, it is just another satellite, and so it also needs to have a disposal plan. So we do have one, and there's two types of planning that we're doing. One is the eventual plan for end of life. So when we're all done, we'll slowly decommission it and bring it in for a targeted reentry. And then we also have to have a contingency deorbit or contingency disposal plan. So if for some reason we were forced to abandon the space station and would not be able to get crew back up to it, if some sort of emergency were to happen, then we also still have to be able to dispose of it properly and safely. And so we do have both of those plans. And it's a 420,000 kilo spacecraft, so it's it's not just a small thruster burn to deorbit it. So it's going to be a gradual process. I think about 6 months and a couple of Progress cargo ships to get enough propellant up there.
Meanwhile, people can go outside and see the International Space Station pass over Melbourne quite frequently.
Yeah, absolutely. Australia has a fantastic opportunity to see the space station regularly, and that's because we swing from descending to ascending nodes pretty much over Australia, or if not, just east or west of it. So it's Australia has a great vantage point to be able to see overflights quite a bit, and so spotthestation.nasa.gov is a great website to go to see when it'll fly over your head.
What brings you to Australia?
I am had the opportunity to be a speaker at a conference called Mainstream Conference. It's hosted by the Eventful Group, and they're talking about heavy industry, like mining and gas and oil and things like that, and they talk about how to manage their assets to help with ensure availability of equipment so that they can increase their productivity, increase their bottom line, and not have wasted equipment, wasted time of equipment. And so they were looking for a unique speaker to talk about something that was similar. And space station is very similar to that. We're not trying to increase our bottom line, but we are trying to increase our product, which is the research that can only be done on the space station in low Earth orbit. So we're always looking for ways to optimize how we do maintenance and how we do operations so that we can increase that output. So I'm talking to the folks here about how we do that optimization in the human spaceflight world, and they might be able to take some of that and apply it to their industry as well. So they contacted NASA and proposed the idea, and asked for a speaker, and it worked out so that could be me, and I get to experience the conference. Actually was in Perth, and now it's in Melbourne, so I'll be talking to the next couple of days and then heading back home.
Well, thank you for joining us on the Space Show.
Yeah, it's absolutely my pleasure, and I'm just grateful that to have run into so many people that are so interested and really participating with this grand effort of getting people off the planet. So my pleasure.
Thank you.